In Adam Grant's New York Times bestseller Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World, he focuses on an underappreciated subset of American culture, the trailblazers among us. Why do some people with bold ideas succeed while others fail? What gives some people the courage to constantly go against the grain and buck outdated traditions? Is it possible to become less conformist as we age, or are we either born risk takers or not? Bolstered by his own research, as well as the latest studies of his peers, Adam Grant answers these questions and more, proving that to be groundbreaking, one needn't necessarily move fast or take enormous risks. As it turns out, true originals might be more afraid than any of us of making the wrong move. They just know how to use their own fear to their advantage. Adam Grant is a best-selling author and a professor of the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. The name of the book, Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. It is now out in paperback, and it's a pleasure to welcome Adam Grant back to the roundtable. Sir, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us. Can you hear me okay, sir?
I can, yes.
Excellent. Good morning and welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thrilled to be here.
Terrific. What you know, we had you on when the hardcover came out. What has this journey been like over the past year of how people have responded to what you have been talking about in regards to nonconformists?
Oh, it's been fun to hear people say, "So you're telling me I should procrastinate more, have more bad ideas, and live in constant fear?" And my answer is yes. Okay, maybe not. I think that it's worth knowing that these are common experiences for even the most creative people in the world. And I don't want people to necessarily put off their deadlines more. I don't want them to deliberately come up with bad ideas. I just want to normalize these behaviors, right, and help people understand that the more creative you are, the more bad ideas you are going to have, because you're just going to have more ideas in general. And that sometimes procrastination means that you haven't figured it out yet, and you need to give yourself a little bit more time to incubate.
So how do you define a nonconformist? What does that mean to you?
I think of nonconformists as the people who are comfortable standing out and speaking up, who aren't afraid to rock the boat, who enjoy challenging the status quo, and who look at the world around them and constantly ask, why isn't it better, and what can I do about it? And then take the initiative to try to change it.
So you explore this in the book, and this I find very interesting. But is this something that you develop over time, or are there that are seeds that are planted very, very early in our DNA?
I think it's always a little bit of both. But the good news on nature-nurture questions is that there are huge nurture effects here. And you know, I think this is really important for parents and teachers to be aware of. It's really hard to raise a creative child, but it's pretty easy to thwart a child's creativity. So we know that in schools, for example, the kids who are the most creative and nonconforming are the least likely to be teachers' pets. Right? They're constantly asking questions and interrupting, and teachers right. find them annoying, and they try to sort of shove them back in line. And that really stifles the opportunities the kids have to think outside the box. And so, you know, I think that it's actually less about trying to, you know, develop these capabilities and more about just making sure that we don't squash them.
And creativity is very much a part of this equation, right? I mean, that's how we measure this in many ways.
Yeah, very much so. But I don't want to stop at creativity, right? I think it's one thing to have new ideas. It's a whole different thing to try to act on them. And I really wrote Originals as a bit of a sequel to creativity, you know, to say, look, we all have ideas for improving the world around us. What do you do after you have an idea? Like, how do you know if it's any good? How do you speak up effectively?
When you know, I mean, one of the things here, and again, you tackle this in the book, is that many of us want to speak up. We have an idea, and yet we just can't find it within ourselves to actually say it. And you talk about this. So this also gets very psychological as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. I was stunned to discover that when you look at people across industries and you ask them, you know, just think of the, you know, the biggest idea you had for improving your workplace. or, you know, an important suggestion that came to mind. What did you do when you had that idea or suggestion? Turns out 85% of people said, I never told anybody. I stayed silent. And a lot of people think that's because of fear. And fear does hold people back, right? I think many of us work in places that are psychologically unsafe, where we know that if, you know, we challenge our boss, we're going to get punished. But even more powerful than fear was another factor that was holding people back, which was futility. Saying, you know, I don't think anything bad is going to happen to me if I voice my opinion here, but I just don't believe that it's going to do any good. I think it'll fall on deaf ears, so why should I bother to try? Mm. And those beliefs persist even when people have no evidence for it, right? So you could follow up and ask people, have you ever seen somebody's ideas shot down or ignored? And very frequently in the data, people say, no, but, you know, I think this is the kind of place where that would happen. And so, you know, I just don't bother to try.
Does the adage know what battles you want to fight enter into this? You know, of when you want to rock the boat and when you don't, of when it's advantageous and when it's not.
Yeah, I think it's a huge factor. So one of the mistakes that we see, you know, the nonconformists and originals among us make, is they don't know how to temper their radicalism, and so it feels like every battle is worth fighting. And they end up alienating a lot of people or just being perceived as, you know, kind of too contrarian, too iconoclastic. And, you know, it's like, all right, here goes Joe again, like, speaking up with another idea. You know, can you please get out of the way so we can do some work?
Right.
And I think that what you see with successful, you know, people who really manage to champion new ideas effectively is they learn to temper those habits. Right. They say, look, I'm going to find, you know, the right place, the right time, the right audience. And then if that doesn't work, I'm going to go back to the drawing board and, you know, try to figure out how to improve the pitch, as opposed to always being the nail that sticks out and just waiting for somebody to pound me down.
You have a chapter in the book. It comes toward the end, middle to the end, which is rocking the boat and keeping it steady. That's the double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the paradox for me is, I found this in some of my own research, that when people are most motivated to speak up, they're the least effective in doing it. And so often, you know, you see something happen that's just unfair or wrong, and you feel this, you know, this extreme frustration or anger, it might be righteous indignation. You say, all right, I'm going to march into my boss's office and do something about it. And that's when, of course, you have no logical arguments. You end up offending the people that you're trying to persuade. And so, you know, I think if you want to rock the boat while keeping your own emotions steady, you have to figure out how to manage that. And I think the biggest lesson that I learned in writing the book is it's so critical to stand for something, not just against something. I think that, you know, my favorite way of capturing this was a colleague of mine who said, after studying this, the key thing to remember is if you want to point out that the emperor has no clothes, you better make sure you're a pretty good tailor first. And yeah, I think that a lot of people recognize that, but yeah, they only master one kind of sewing, right? So it's like, I see this problem and I know I have to be constructive, not just complaining, so I'm going to come up with the perfect solution. And the problem is that, you know, we don't always know what the perfect solution is. And so I think, you know, what we see is most of the time, you know, the way you keep it steady is you say, look, I'm going to come in with three or four ideas for how to tackle this problem, and I'm going to be really open to, you know, to pitching several of them until I can, you know, get the people that I'm trying to get to take me seriously to really pay attention.
Here's an interesting figure in the book. In a study of every set of brothers ever to play Major League Baseball, the younger siblings were 10.6 times more likely than the older siblings to attempt to steal a base. This gets into birth order, and I want you to explain some of the studies that we know regarding first and latter-born siblings.
Yeah, this is incredibly controversial. I think it's one of the messiest topics in all of social science. Lots of conflicting studies. Nobody agrees on anything. But I will say, as a firstborn, I was really intrigued by a series of studies suggesting that oftentimes laterborns are more willing to take risks and more willing to be nonconformists, and that can make them more creative. And sure enough, when you look at Major League Baseball, not only when you look at all these brothers who played and, you know, come from the same families and they have similar genetics, not only are the later borns more likely to try to steal a base, but they're substantially more likely to succeed in stealing a base. And this really made me mad as a firstborn, right? but what you see is that oftentimes there are two effects at play here. One is that firstborns are much more likely to sort of occupy the traditional niche. So, you know, they end up being like the high achiever. They end up being the one who sort of obeys their parents and, you know, wants to follow all the rules. And laterborns are looking for a way to stand out, and often that means rebelling. And as they do that over and over again, sometimes it becomes a little bit more comfortable for them. And then the other thing that happens is we've all seen parents get more permissive as they have more children.
Right.
The firstborn, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm going to raise a bubble baby because I don't want my kid to ever get sick or in trouble. And you end up being very overprotective. And then, you know, by the time you have a third child, you're like, yeah, sure, you can eat the table. That sounds very nutritious. And because kids then end up with, you know, fewer rules, fewer restrictions, they end up, you know, getting away with more. And that also kind of nudges them in the risk-taking direction. And when you add those things up, sometimes you do see the later born stealing more bases.
I'm the youngest of five, so a lot of this I like. But that nine times before Darwin, nine times more likely than firstborns to advocate for evolution. Prior to Galileo, laterborns five times more likely than firstborns to believe that the Earth revolves around the sun. I don't even know how you acquired that information.
Yeah, there's a historian of science, Frank Soloway, who did the dirty work on that. But what was so interesting about that is, you know, when you track scientists, there's a point at which people have to start questioning their beliefs, right? So are you going to believe that the Earth actually revolves around the sun instead of vice versa, right? Are you going to believe that, you know, that evolution might be real? And what you see is that firstborns often take longer to get on board with those kinds of changes. They're more used to sort of, you know, sticking with the establishment. Laterborns are like, you know what? I don't really care what anybody else thinks. And, you know, I always feel bad for middle children because they just end up in footnotes in these studies, right? Which is like, okay, guess what, middle children? Here it is again. Like, you're getting overlooked not only by your parents, but by scientists too. But I think that, you know, typically what you see is there is a little bit more reluctance among firstborns, you know, to challenge the establishment. And yeah, that means that sometimes firstborns have a harder time with disruption, harder time with change. But the good news is we can all learn to adjust our attitudes and our behaviors. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written the book in the first place.
So at the end of the book, you have actions for impact if for a person who is seeking to unleash this originality. Is this for everyone?
I hope so. You know, I think we can all learn to be more effective at pitching our ideas. We can all learn to you know, occasionally
right.
say, look, just because the world was created this way doesn't mean that's the best way to do it. And I think there are small habits that we can all adopt that help us move in that direction wherever we start.
The name of the book, Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. It is by Adam Grant. The book is now out in paperback. It was number one New York Times bestseller. And it's a fascinating read. Adam, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for coming back and talking to us.